In 1935, cars were plentiful, but jobs were scarce. When the Iowa State Highway Safety Patrol was founded and the call was put out for patrolmen, more than 3,000 men applied. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. 50 of those men made the cut. This hour, we'll explore the history of what is now called the Iowa State Patrol. We'll hear the story of those first 50 officers, and we'll find out about the woman who made it all possible. The patrol was founded by Iowa's first woman Secretary of State, Ola Babcock Miller. I'll talk with Scott Fisher, author of Iowa State Patrol, and West Branch Police Chief Mike Horahan. Join our conversation after the news. You're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we'll explore the history of what is now called the Iowa State Patrol, founded in 1935. We'll talk about the woman, Iowa's first woman Secretary of State, who made the patrol her top priority, and the first 50 officers of the patrol who made it a reality. With me is Scott Fisher. He's author of Iowa State Patrol, a new book from the Images of America series. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Charity.
Welcome back to the show.
And thank you.
West Branch Police Chief Mike Horahan is also with us. He's also an archivist for the Iowa State Patrol and served with the patrol for many years. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
And I want to start way back in the 1930s. And Scott, maybe you can start by painting a picture for us of what the roads and traffic in Iowa would have been like in the early 1930s.
Well, they were not what we have today by any means. They were a few paved, but the rest were dirt roads, gravel roads, lots of ruts this time of year. There's an old saying, pick your ruts carefully. You're going to be in them for a long time. So the roads could not keep up with the cars that Detroit was building. So there were a lot of accidents just because the speeds were too fast and the roads were very poor.
And by speeds too fast, probably 35 miles an hour unheard
of speed. Yeah.
Right. But at the same time, there were just more and more and more cars, even in Iowa.
Right, right. The number of driver's licenses would go up, 10 times each year, it seemed like. So people were...
And when you say driver's license, what was a driver's license in the 1930s?
Well, you went down and took a 10-question test and got a little disc for a dollar. That was about it.
Okay, so pretty much anybody could get one.
Anybody, mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, so there are terrible roads. There are cars all over the place. How about traffic laws? Were there even laws that ruled the roads?
Well, Mike can probably speak to this because he's done a lot of research with... Was one of the speeds careful and prudent? Was the speed limit something like that?
Back in the old days, they didn't have a posted speed limit. It was considered safe and reasonable speeds. And sometimes that was hard to enforce. What you consider safe and reasonable may not be safe and reasonable to me.
Right. Well, and if there were traffic laws or rules of the road, were they consistent across the state of Iowa?
The enforcement probably wasn't consistent. And I think there was, since there was lack of law enforcement, I think enforcement was badly needed and it wasn't done, I guess. So there was really very little monitoring that was going on with the motoring public back then.
And also, because now people had cars, this also created a real opportunity for lawlessness at the same time, right?
Yes, it did.
What were some of the problems the cars created?
Well, one thing is if you were a bank robber or something like that, you could commit your crime in one part of the state and escape to another part of the state very quickly. And that was new, that you couldn't get very far in the older days with just horseback or running away. But with cars, you could be into the next state very quickly. The old Bonnie and Clyde and John Dillinger, that was the height of their fame, and they were using the cars to their advantage.
I remember a story my grandpa told me about. He was hitchhiking back to Iowa from South Dakota in the 1930s and got picked up by a moonshiner. So people were running liquor through the state as well. There were a lot of crazy things going on.
Right. Yeah. And they were oleomargarine was not approved in the state. So that was being smuggled up from Missouri. So things, it wasn't even just liquor. There are all kinds of things being
smuggled
in.
Dangerous margarine smugglers.
A lot of people don't realize, too, is back in the 30s, there was very little radio communication. Even when the State Patrol was formed in 1935, it was several years before we actually got two-way radio communication. Communication was usually done by scanners and by telephone.
So there wasn't a lot of back and forth across the state as people were taking advantage of that. Well, let's talk about 1932, because a very important player comes on the political scene in Iowa in 1932, and that is Ola Babcock Miller, who ran for election for Iowa's Secretary of State. And she really did not expect to be elected Secretary of State. Clearly, it was unheard of for a woman to be elected Secretary of State. What even put her in this position, Scott?
Well, she and her husband had run a newspaper in Washington, Iowa, and he had passed away, but he had been a publisher of the newspaper. They'd both been very active Republicans, but they had kind of switched over to the Democrats when Franklin Roosevelt came on the scene. They really believed in him. And they did a lot of work for him. So as part of a thank you to her, the Democratic Party put her on the ticket for Secretary of State. And no one really thought she would win, but win she did.
And she just squeaked in that first election.
Yeah, but she did win. And her big thing was that shortly before her election, a friend of hers had a son that was very close to her. And the son was killed in an automobile accident. And that was kind of the tipping point for her and the crusade about highway safety. She vowed to make it Iowa a lot safer with the roads and the enforcement.
So as she started crusading for safer traffic laws in Iowa and for the Iowa Highway Safety Patrol, as she called it, what was the political climate like for that kind of legislation that had been tried before?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
It was awful because it was Mike can explain this a little better as far as the political and the private police force that people were afraid was going to get formed.
They were a little afraid that it was going to be turned into union busting. They were afraid that the State Patrol would be brought forth for union busting. And there was some fear. There was some fear that a political party that was in control would have their own police force. And so one thing Mrs. Miller tried to do was to kind of cross all kinds of political lines and get it across to people that this is for the betterment of Iowa. The public motoring safety was important that we needed to start working on.
How do you think she accomplished that? Because, again, I mean, nobody expected her to get elected. I'm guessing that once she got elected, nobody really expected her to do anything with her position as the first female Secretary of State. What do you think gave her that power?
Well, she did two things, or actually numerous things. She went around to different areas and different communities and promoted her program, went out to the people, so to speak. Another thing she did was she published articles and put that out there. And also one thing she did was start kind of an experimental state patrol of 15 motor vehicle inspectors. And that's how back in 32, 34 in that area, that's how the patrol got their early start or at least proved their worthwhileness is to get the inspectors out there. And the inspectors went out there and promoted safety and gave a lot of public presentations and things like that, and really got the word out that, hey, we're out here to help the citizens of Iowa and to make the road safer.
In your book, Scott, when there were a few pages about vehicle inspections, and I think this was later on, but as the officers were looking at vehicles and doing vehicle inspections, there were cars that didn't even have lights.
Right.
I mean, it sounds like these automobiles were all over the place.
Right. And it's interesting, too, that she put them out there and then brought them back in and did some surveys about how people liked the idea. And people really liked the idea, except that they weren't in any uniform. And they weren't sure if they were really being stopped by a state official. So she put them in uniforms, which they had to pay for. Each guy had to buy his own uniform. And then put them back out there. And the public really liked it.
She seemed to have a real knack for public relations.
Right.
When she was campaigning, she created a pamphlet where she had someone did the illustration of the four horsemen of the highway, the road hog, the drunken driver, excessive speed, and unsafe cars. I mean, she really seemed to come up with ways to capture the public imagination.
And she was one of those people who says it's better to ask forgiveness than ask permission. She would just go out and do stuff, and then if someone above her thought it was not a good idea, they might talk to her. But they couldn't argue with the results because traffic deaths went down, and people liked the inspectors coming to their town, talking to church groups, talking to civic leaders, just about highway safety.
So the Highway Safety Patrol was founded in 1935. I mean, this is after those first 15 officers had already been out and about. But this is when it was made official. What did that legislation set aside funding for?
It set aside enough for 50 officers and three commanders. It also set aside money for a camp, a training camp, which was at Camp Dodge, which at that time was pretty much part of it was abandoned. It had been a World War I base. So it paid for having that upgraded so they could have their program there. So they put out the word, and 3,000 men, it was only men back then, applied. And out of that, they picked about 100 of that 3,000 to go to the camp.
And the camp was 7 weeks long?
Yeah. It was paramilitary. They stayed in barracks, and one of the first things they had to do was clean up the camp and cut all the big horse weeds. And Mike and I got to interview a lot of those guys when they were still living, and they remembered very clearly you either ran a lawnmower or a sickle, and one of the two. And you were out there cutting weeds and cleaning the floors in the barracks and cleaning the stoves that hadn't been used in years. So, and they had inspection every day, just like in the military.
It struck me as really interesting how very tough that first training camp was, and the fact that they were sort of making it up as they went along. But clearly they had a goal that they wanted this to be something that you really had to get through, like basic training.
Back then, police academies are almost unheard of. In 1935, and I think that's one thing that separated the Iowa Safety Patrol / the Iowa State Patrol from any other organization is they started the academy in 1935. It wasn't until the early 70s that academies were actually required by state law.
Interesting. And Mrs. Miller was there interviewing applicants. She was very hands-on in selecting who would be the first 50 officers.
She definitely interviewed a lot of that first 3,000, not that many, but quite a few. And she definitely interviewed all of that 100. That whole group had been all interviewed by Mrs. Miller at some point.
And what was her vision for them? Because she seemed to have a very strong vision for who these men should be.
Her thing was save lives first, worry about the money after. Just get out there and promote highway safety. That was the number one thing she would drill into them over and over again. And John Hattery was the first chief, and he ran the camp, and that was his thing, too.
We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This hour, we're exploring the history of the Iowa State Patrol. And with me is Scott Fisher. He is author of Iowa State Patrol, a new book from the Images of America series. West Branch, Branch Police Chief Mike Horan is also here. He's also an archivist for the Iowa State Patrol and retired from the patrol as well. I'm Charity Nebbe, and you're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. You're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're exploring the history of the Iowa State Patrol. We are also talking about the woman who made the Iowa State Patrol possible, Ola Babcock Miller, our first female Secretary of State. The Iowa State Patrol was founded in 1935. And with me today, Scott Fisher, author of Iowa State Patrol, a new book from the Images of America series, and West Branch Police Chief Mike Horahan, who's also an archivist for the Iowa State Patrol. We'd love to hear from you as well. You can join our conversation. If you have Iowa State Patrol history in your family, we'd love to hear your stories. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And so the first 50 officers, they had to go through this training camp for 7 weeks. Half of them were weeded out during that time. 50 remained. And this was 1935. So jobs were scarce. These jobs were certainly prized. They didn't make a whole lot of money at it. What did they get paid?
No, they got $100 a month, and that was it. I mean, no pension, no health benefits. They had to buy their own ammunition. It was just pretty much $100 a month. But all the guys that Mike and I talked to who are from that first group all said the same thing, that it was a job, and they were just glad to have a job.
Absolutely. Well, and so those first 50 officers, what kind of vehicles were they out on patrol in?
They mostly drove Ford V8s. It wasn't a souped-up car at all. It was just off the showroom floor, basically. Or Indian 74 motorcycles. They would drive those in good weather. So there were a few Pontiacs and a few Chevys, but mostly were the Ford V8s, which a lot of the bad guys had Buicks and Packards, so they were kind of underpowered if they had to give chase on those.
Well, and Mike, you mentioned radio not being two-way. So what kind of communication did they have from headquarters when they were out there?
At certain times of day, they went to certain locations, and they had scanners in their patrol vehicles, and they basically tuned in those frequencies and listened for the radio broadcasts.
And what kind of protection did they have? They carried a sidearm.
They carried a .38 revolver, and that's about all they had for weapons back then. In fact, the first Iowa State Highway Patrolman went out on patrol unarmed the first day or two. It wasn't for a period of time that they were issued sidearms.
Even though they had gone through training during that 7-week camp, they had learned how to shoot if they didn't already know. That had been part of their training.
Yes, and I think she wanted to make Iowans feel safe with the new police force, and I think that was really what she did. And as she never stopped promoting the organization and keeping track of statistics and promoting her program and her officers and that kind of thing. She had a personal investment in those officers and how they performed.
Well, and Ola Babcock Miller also insisted on courtesy. That was part of her mantra as well, that these officers needed to treat everyone that they encountered with respect.
That's absolutely true, and that's why it's still in our motto, courtesy, service, protection. I think she really promoted that, and it's something that the Iowa State Patrol has promoted throughout all these years. Also, she really promoted the officers to go out and give programs, safety programs. So it's not just enforcement. It's about building community relationships, about promoting safety, different community groups, and things like that.
Well, and as we were talking about before, in the early 30s, there weren't that many rules of the road, and people didn't necessarily know what those rules were. So the education part of this was extremely important.
Oh, very much so.
Let's talk about something that happened in 1936, and this was the first death of an Iowa State patrolman on the job. Orrin, he was better known as Nanny Pape. Who wants to tell me that story?
Well, I'll start, and then Mike can fill in. He was a football star at Iowa for the Hawkeyes earlier, and then he'd played some professional football, I think, for Green Bay. But when the patrol opportunity came up, he was one of the first ones that was selected. He was on patrol down on old Highway 61 by Fairport, which is now Highway 22, I think. And he stopped a guy for he thought it was a stolen car, which it was. And the man's name was Barton, and he was a parolee who had stolen some cars. And he walked up to the car, and Barton got the drop on him and forced him into the car with him and started driving down the road. And at some point there, Pape tried to overpower him and was shot. And they kept struggling. Even though he was shot, he kept struggling and shot the other guy who died. So he laid there in the road, and two men came along and picked him up and took him to the Muscatine Hospital where they operated. And it was a couple of days, but he died from his wounds. And that was huge because it was the first time someone had been murdered, and no one has been murdered since as a member of the Highway Patrol either. But that was when the patrol switched over to cross-draw, which they had for years. Mike,
and what does that mean?
The holsters are located so you draw across your body.
And that would keep someone from being able to grab your gun? Is that the idea?
The State Patrol, I think, back in the old days, wanted to have a weapon that was out of view. So they went with a kind of a flap. Also, the thought was if you put it on your left side, it's not in reach of the person that would sit next to you. So that's why the early years, that's why the Iowa Highway Patrol went with the cross-draw holster.
Okay. And after the murder of Orrin Pape, that must have really shaken a lot of people up, but it also really made people aware of how vulnerable these men were out there on the Iowa State Patrol. What were some of the other changes that murder started? Or were there others?
In that time period, that was about the only change I remember, you know, in 1935, 1936 area. Since then, as the State Patrol has progressed, there's been lots of changes. But back then, I think that's the only change they made. I think it was thought upon, you know, she stressed courtesy and not being aggressive. And I think that's maybe part of the reason why the officer, it's felt, approached the car with his weapon holstered.
And were there rules about that you couldn't draw your weapon first? Was that a rule?
At first, I think I know that they brought them back after Pape was killed. They had another training session, and they brought in half of them at a time to Camp Dodge, and they worked on hand-to-hand. They'd done this during their basic training camp too, but they emphasized de-arming someone with a weapon and more of that than they had done before. And after that, they were allowed to come up to a car with their weapons drawn if they thought it was necessary. Not unless they were really sure, though, because Mrs. Miller, like you said, really wanted the public to feel safe and not worry about the weapons and the guns part of it.
After those first 50 officers were on the road, Mrs. Miller was not satisfied yet. I mean, she was clearly happy with the success of that. But what were some of the other initiatives that she was trying to push forward in the years after that?
Well, like Mike said, she would really encourage those officers to get involved in their community and go talk about safety everywhere they went. She wanted more officers, and she pushed through legislation to actually increase the patrol by more troopers, have more training camps, which she was able to do. She didn't live to see that, but she did get the bills passed with her, and it's actually because of the work the troopers had done. Like Mike said, she kept meticulous figures and statistics about how much the deaths had gone down, how much the people were really more trusting of police officers and that sort of thing. So she had a really good case for having more troopers on the road. And she proved that it wasn't a political issue, as people had feared. She kind of put those people's fears to rest on that. So they did approve the increase of the patrol rather quickly.
And you mentioned she didn't live to see these things come to fruition. Mm-hmm. She died in 1937,
right.
So only 2 years after the patrol was founded. What happened?
Right. She got pneumonia. She had the flu, and then she got pneumonia, and she was hospitalized. And, of course, back then they didn't have the medicine that we have now or the knowledge of diseases. And the troopers visited her in the hospital, which she ordered them not to, but they came anyway. She's ordered them not to buy her flowers, but they did anyway. And she made a statement saying that's the only time her boys, she always called them her boys, disobeyed one of her orders. But tragically, yeah, she died. And so in a very short period, the patrol lost Nanny Pape and then lost Oleg Babcock Miller. So it was a tough time for them for a while.
And when she came down with the flu, she was on a speaking tour.
Exactly.
Trying to rally support for the further changes she wanted to make.
She was out there just as much as her troopers were. It didn't really stop from when she was elected, and a lot of her own time was spent on icy roads out there with little towns. She'd go, if there were three or four people together in a group, she'd be there to talk about highway safety.
We're talking this hour about the history of the Iowa State Patrol, and with me, Scott Fisher, author of Iowa State Patrol, and West Branch Police Chief Mike Horahan, who served in the Iowa State Patrol from 1977 through 2012?
Yes.
All right. And we'd love to hear from you as well. If you have this history in your family, or maybe you're a retired patrolman yourself, give us a call at 866-780-9100, or a retired patrol woman as well. And Ola Babcock Miller would be disappointed in me for that slip. Charles is on the line next from Des Moines. Hi, Charles.
Hey, how are you?
Good. And you're retired from the State Patrol?
Yes, I am. I worked 35 years as a trooper, and I worked with Mine Corps Hand, and I'm familiar with Scott's books, and as a matter of fact, I'm president of the Retired Association, and Scott sent us his prototype before it was published. We sent it out to all the members to check over it to make sure to see if there were any errors in it, and there were a couple of small things we found that we sent back. So I know Scott's book is going to be very accurate.
Well, I think you'll enjoy it. And you are retired State Patrol Sergeant Charles Black, right?
Right.
All right. And you know, Mike and I were talking during the break about how it seems that a lot of Iowa State Patrol members have these very long careers, how you seem to get into the patrol and not get out. That clearly happened to you, Charles. So what do you think it is that that keeps patrolmen and women in the State Patrol for so long?
It's the challenge of the job. It's an interesting job. You never know what to expect when you go to work from day to day, but it's always something to look forward to, and you can always find something to do, work to do out there. Some mornings hated getting up, but I never hated to go to work.
What were you probably did many things over those 35 years. Can you give me kind of an idea of the breadth of your responsibilities?
Well, I started out working as a trooper, or actually a highway patrolman back in 1965 in Polk County, and I worked road enforcement, started out working driver's license for a couple of years, and then I transferred to road enforcement and worked road enforcement on the road until 1985 when I promoted to sergeant, and then I still continued to work a lot of road enforcement but ended up spending more time in the office. I always tried to spend as little time as I could in the office, as much time out on the road working with the troopers.
How does that feel to approach a car that you've stopped? That strikes me as a very vulnerable moment.
You always approach with caution. You always look for things. There are a lot of clues you can look for as you make the stop. What's he doing up in the car? Is he digging around? Does he look like he's trying to hide something? Does he look like he's trying to pick up something? How does he sit in the car, you know? Watch their hands. You know, you hear a lot of people tell you different things, but if they're going to hit you or pull a weapon, it's going to be with their hand. So you always watch their hands and just use caution and try to approach them. And once you get a feel for them, then you know whether you can need to keep your guard up or can let it down.
Did you ever have someone pull a weapon on you?
A couple of times, yes.
Is there an experience you can share with us?
Well, I'll share one story with you. It's we had a radio call that there'd been a murder in Illinois. This man had shot his, not his stepson, his wife's son. And the son was the same age as this man, and then the wife and the son had a two-year-old, and after he committed the murder, he'd taken the two-year-old and left Illinois and said, called some family members and said if the police tried to stop him, he'd kill himself and the baby. Mm-hmm. And so when he came through here, we spotted him. We got him stopped. I went up to the car, and he was holding the gun up to his head at that time. And stayed back away from the car far enough that I could hear him, and I kept talking to him. And I finally talked him into opening the passenger door so that I could hear him. And about that time, he lowered the gun, and I thought, oh, no, he's going to shoot the baby, so... About, I started to take up slack in the weapon, then trigger, and then about that time he raised the gun on the other side of his head. But eventually I talked him into, if he'd lay the gun in the seat, I came up and talked to him. He could see me, and he knew I was telling him the truth and everything was going to be all right. And he laid the gun down, and I stepped up and grabbed the gun, and then we took him out and saved the baby.
Wow. When you think back on experiences like that one, what are you most proud of that you accomplished as a patrolman?
I think probably the different situations where I was able to help people to save lives. I received a letter one time from some people who'd been in an accident that I'd helped, and it was a thank you letter, and the amazing part about it was written 10 years after the accident.
Wow, they were still thinking about it, and you.
Yeah, and thought enough about it to send a letter.
Wow. Well, Charles,
one thing I'd like to mention that Sergeant Black is doing is he's been very instrumental in getting bridges named for the troopers who have died in the line of duty. You'll see the signs on the highways around the state that the Orrin Pape Memorial Bridge, and he's been really instrumental in getting that done.
Well, Sergeant Black, thank you so much for calling and sharing your story with us today.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Retired Iowa State Patrol Sergeant Charles Black, he is also president of the Retired Iowa Peace Officers Association. And Mike, you spent a lot of years on the road. What did it feel like for you when you approached a car?
When I was first broke in, the officer told me, if you realized how many cars had weapons in them, you probably wouldn't stop them. You'd probably quit tomorrow. And that's one thing they've taught us right from the start, to be very safe. And that's one thing I would have to say is my career has been very diverse. I've had the opportunity to help protect three presidents. I've been to prison riots. I've made some successful drug seizures. I've arrested murderers. It's been a really rewarding career. And anything can happen. And I just enjoyed being a part of that organization, and I have a lot of pride in the organization.
We will continue talking about the Iowa State Patrol in a moment. This hour, we're exploring the history of the Iowa State Patrol. With me is West Branch Police Chief Mike Horahan, who is also an archivist for the Iowa State Patrol and served from 1977 to 2012. And also, Scott Fisher is here. He's the author of Iowa State Patrol, a new book from the Images of America series. This is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm Charity Nebbe, and this is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa. This hour, we're talking about the history of the Iowa State Patrol. And with me, West Branch Police Chief Mike Horahan, who's an archivist for the Iowa State Patrol and served on the patrol from 1977 to 2012. And Scott Fisher is here. He's the author of a new book, Iowa State Patrol, a book from the Images of America series. And we'd love to hear your stories as well at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we were talking about what it feels like to approach a vehicle, and I was struck earlier, we talked about the murder of Nanny Pape, and I was struck by a story in your book, Scott, about John Mankey in 1945, again, driving home the point that these men were really alone out there for a really long time. What happened to John Mankey?
Yeah, he, matter of fact, I interviewed Mr. Mankey, and he was very casual about it, but he was in a town and happened to notice a car that he thought might be stolen with some people in it. And once again, they kind of got the drop on him and forced him into the car, took him out in the country, drove all over the rural Iowa trying to find a place to put him, and they finally found an old schoolhouse. Actually, it was the second one. They found one schoolhouse. That wasn't good enough, so they went to another schoolhouse and left him there. And he said that
handcuffed
him to the stove in this old schoolhouse. And he said that he was afraid that they were going to kill him. But once they got into that schoolhouse and chained him to the stove, he knew that they were – now he had to worry about freezing.
Right, I was going to say, they weren't going to kill him, but they might have.
Yeah, they just
kind
of left him there. And so
it was cold.
It was cold. And he spent the night just beating his handcuffs against this cast iron stove until it finally broke. And he was able to get out and walk to a farmhouse, and where he had the farmer, and that farmer I don't believe had a phone. I think he had to go to the neighbor to get a phone to call somebody at patrol, and they came and got him. But yeah, it was just one of those things where, and like I said, interviewing him years later, he's passed away now, but he was very, that was not the high point of his patrol career.
No,
he was more,
I would say not.
And it wasn't what he talked about the most about his patrol career. He was more happy, like Mike's talking about, helping people. That's what he wanted to talk about more than that incident.
One of the things that I was struck by in reading your book was how incredibly well documented with photographs a lot of the work of these first 50 officers was. And for example, there's a picture of John Menke in his handcuffs. Was that a goal of someone to make sure that this was all well documented?
My great uncle was one of the first 50, and in talking to his daughter, she tells about coming home and finding boxes and boxes of photographs that they were told to carry a camera for accident scenes or places in the road that looked unsafe that needed to be fixed. They took lots and lots of pictures.
And there's one photo that I was really struck by. Now, I can't remember the name of the escaped convict, but troopers had helped track him down, and there he is in his handcuffs in a posed shot with several of the people who had captured him. I thought that must have been an uncomfortable photo to take.
That was pretty typical of the air, I think, too. Law enforcement, when they made a big arrest like that, they really liked to promote it.
All right. Claudette is on the line from Ellsworth. Hello, Claudette.
Good morning.
And you had an uncle who was a state patrolman?
Yes, my uncle was one of those early patrolmen. He was NB Mike Wilson, and we'd heard lots of stories about his experiences as a state trooper. The one that is kind of more famous was that he stopped a speeding car, and as he approached it, the driver said to him, "Do you know who I am?" And my Uncle Mike said, "Yes, you're Bob Feller, but I'm Mike Wilson, and I'm giving you a ticket."
Famous baseball star,
right.
By the way.
Right. I'm sorry, I should have filled that
star.
In.
Yes. And I was going to say that we have enjoyed the portion of the Gold Star Museum on Camp Dodge that is about the Iowa State Troopers. And when my uncle passed away, it was a very stirring sight to see six troopers carry his casket and the procession that they made to the gravesite for him. And it was very special to our family.
Well, Claudette, thank you so much for your call. And Mike, there does seem to be a really strong bond among troopers.
Well, I think so. Anytime a trooper dies, whether off-duty, on-duty, retired, they have the option of having an honor guard, and we're pretty proud of our honor guard.
What do you think that means? I mean, why is there this bond and this commitment to past troopers?
I think the fact that we work together and share the same responsibilities and the same jobs, I think there's a bond there. I mean, we're out there kind of by ourselves, out there promoting safety, getting drunks off the road, getting the bad guys off the road. And I think and we're working weekends and holidays and Christmases, and I think there's a relationship that we build with our fellow officers and a pride and respect.
Doug is on the line from Ames. Hi, Doug.
Hi. Yeah, this is Doug Meinhardt from Ames. My father was one of the first 50 patrolmen on the highway patrol. He has several interesting stories. I asked him once if he'd ever shot anybody, and he said the only time that he came close to using his weapon was when they had stopped an escaped convict. I think there were several highway patrolmen there. And the convict started to run away from them. And he hollered at the man to stop it right there. And he slapped the weapon on the side of his waist. And the man stopped then, realizing that he could have been shot. But Dad said there's no way that he would have taken a shot at him because there were several other people around. Mm. And he was in so much better shape than that guy that he would have easily ran him down. So that was the only time he came close to firing his weapon.
How long did your dad serve, Doug?
He was on the patrol for 10 years. My understanding was he had a very difficult time. He had a daughter, my oldest sister. I don't know exactly how old she was at the time, but quite young. And he went out to an accident scene and had to pick up a young girl off the highway that was the same age. And he said that I think that caused him quite a lot of mental anguish.
Mm-hmm.
And I think after that, he had to quit the patrol.
Oh, Doug, thank you so much for calling.
Sure.
And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. We were talking earlier about the training camp that those first 50 officers went through, and then in your book, Scott, you write about other training camps, and clearly physical fitness and good training is key for state troopers. Is it hard, Mike, to maintain that when you spend that many hours in a car?
I think the State Patrol has really made a special effort to make sure they hire physically fit people. And it is harder to maintain your fitness. For the number of years, though, the State Patrol has had a physical fitness standard that they want people to perform at. So it's always been kind of an issue.
All right. We have an email. This is from Kelly in North Liberty. I wanted to thank our Iowa troopers for their work on RAGBRAI every year. They're very patient and understand the dynamic of riders trying to have fun, but all the while looking out for everyone's safety. It's a great representation of how we want our peace officers to serve the community. And state troopers are even involved in planning the route of RAGBRAI.
We get with the Des Moines Register. The people in headquarters get with the Des Moines Register and plan the route every year. I had the privilege of working RAGBRAI for like 6 years, and it is a ball. It's work, hot hours, dealing with a lot of people. It's, you know, you stop and figure, you move in a town of 20,000 people from one end of the state to another. It's quite a significant feat. It's a lot of work, but a lot of fun too. I really enjoy RAGBRAI.
We have another email. This is from Dan. I'll always enjoy the story of the Winter Twins who managed to stop the same speeder on the same day. I guess he had a hard time trying to figure out how the same trooper who just gave him a ticket managed to get ahead of him and pull him over again for another ticket. Is that a story you're familiar with?
Not that story. I have my own story. I was working with a patrol airplane, and I was working in the Iowa City area, and I knew the airplane was working around Waynesburg, and they had worked that area most of the morning, and the pilot called me up and says, hey, do you want to work a little more just south of Cedar Rapids Airport? And I said, sure. And I stopped a guy, and this guy wasn't very happy, and unfortunately, he had been stopped before by the same airplane. The airplane flew cross country and didn't realize the same guy, but he got stopped twice in the same day. So it was kind of interesting. The motorist wasn't very happy, but he obviously didn't learn his lesson.
Can you give me a rundown of all of the different roles you've played in the State Patrol over the years?
I've had an opportunity to play a lot of different roles, and I'm thankful for every single one of them. I was on the emergency response team, which is like a SWAT team. That emergency response team was started in 1977. I didn't join until a few years later. It is a top-notch crew. Before I retired from the State Patrol, I was a crisis negotiator, like they used to call it a hostage negotiator. I used to be a patrol pilot for a while. I was a safety education officer for the last 6 or 7 years. That's what I did with the State Patrol, was actually promote a lot of programs that Mrs. Miller did. So I've had a lot of different opportunities, and I've had a lot of fun, and it's been a great experience.
Why did you do so many different things? Is that pretty typical, getting moved from one department to another?
It's even when I was a safety education officer, for instance, I was still a crisis negotiator, so I can do multiple things. And that's one thing. We don't have the luxury in the State Patrol of even as a pilot, you were still expected to be a trooper first. So even as a pilot, you went out there and enforced some traffic laws on the ground, covered crashes and that kind of stuff. So the ultimate responsibility, no matter what your specialty was, you were still out there expected to protect the motoring public. But I always like to be diverse. I like to learn different things and do different things, and that's why I did those different things.
Spending so much time on the road, and you mentioned working RAGBRAI, flying over the state, how do you think your work for so many years with the State Patrol changed your feelings about the state of Iowa?
Well, I'm very proud of the state of Iowa. It's a great state, and Sergeant Black touched on it before. You know, when I applied for the job, they asked me why I wanted to apply for the State Patrol. And it was quite simply, I wanted to help people. That may sound kind of corny, but that's exactly what I wanted to do. I like going out there and helping the motoring public. I appreciate making the road safer for other people. And I really is, as a trooper, I really believe that I was employed by the citizens of the state of Iowa. So my job was to make the road safer for the citizens, and also to take some bad people off the road and get some drunks off the road. One thing I would say, too, probably one of the harder things that state troopers have to do is notification next of kin. And I think that's one of the things I really hated to do, but one of the things I was pretty good at and gave my personal touch. And I won't say you ever get used to those fatality crashes, but you know, you learn how to deal with them and you show respect to the people involved and to the situation.
Well, Doug from Ames was talking about how his dad couldn't take it after seeing a fatal crash. That there must have been some really tough times.
There are, and crashes can be so very brutal. I've seen burned out vehicles. The hardest part is when you see young children killed, I would have to say, you know. And so that's one thing I'm a firm believer of is the child safety laws, seatbelts and that kind of stuff.
We have an email from Mike. I think it's worth mentioning that the headquarters building of the Department of Public Safety down the hill from the state capitol is now named for Orrin Pape. It was rededicated last year with his name. And you mentioned Sergeant Black and his involvement in naming bridges for fallen troopers. It strikes me that there has been movement just in the past few years to really make sure that these men and women are getting the recognition they deserve, Scott.
Yeah, and the other thing that the patrol's done is created plaques for the graves of the troopers. If they were Iowa Highway Patrol, they have a stone plaque that's put on their grave that says it's the shield. And if it's Iowa State Patrol, it says that. And those are given out too, which is really a nice touch too.
When a We've only had one trooper murdered in the line of duty, and that was in 1936. But we've had other officers killed in the line of duty, plane crashes and car crashes and things like that. And that's one thing about the state patrol. They retire the badge number, and they put up plaques in the headquarters. And I think it's really important when we hire new officers with the department to have them show respect to the officers and know how those officers died.
In digging into this history, Scott, I was really struck by how much the state patrol has been responsible for over the years. And in reading about changes to how people got driver's licenses in the 1950s, I had no idea it was so easy up until the mid-1950s to get a driver's license.
When I got my driver's license in high school, you went to the driver's license examiner, and that was a state trooper. And, that was kind of disconcerting to have a guy in uniform sitting next to you for your behind-the-wheel test.
Sure.
But I think they were kind of glad to give that up, though. That was a lot of paperwork. And that was in the 70s, late 70s, I think that switched over.
In fact, as a driver's license examiner, some police officers consider that a demotion or maybe a penalty box because, you know, most your troopers want to be on the road.
Right. Well, given all of the different things that troopers have been involved in and responsible for over the years, and we have only a minute left in the show. Mike, what do you think people should know about the Iowa State Patrol that maybe they don't know?
Well, I think they should know that we're people, and they also, I hope, they know that we're out there to help them and protect them. I'd much rather help one motorist broke down than write 100 tickets. It's about helping people, about making the road safer. And I have a lot of pride in the organization, a lot of pride in the people in it, and the job we do. Des Moines Register's done a survey over the number of years, and depending on when the survey was done, some people rate us second to God, some people rate us third to God.
For an institution they have trust in.
Yes, and you don't just – you have to earn that respect, and that's one thing that I really have to appreciate with the organization. We do have a lot of respect with each other, and I hope people have respect for us when I was a trooper.
Mike, thank you so much.
Thank you.
West Branch Police Chief Mike Horahan, he's also an archivist for the Iowa State Patrol and served with the patrol from 1977 to 2012. And Scott Fisher, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity.
Scott Fisher is the author of Iowa State Patrol, a new book from the Images of America series. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by The River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.